Hi, I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
And I'm Maurice McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week, we're talking about cold soups, instant pots, and Rachel Roddy's gorgeous book, My Kitchen in Rome. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week. This came up for me on Facebook. It was this long article about the economics of rotisserie chicken. It grabbed my attention immediately because I have asked myself a million times why the rotisserie chicken is so cheap.
Yeah. It's true.
Have you wondered that?
I have wondered that because I've definitely had that experience of going into a store and having the pre-cooked chicken cost nearly twice as much as a raw chicken and thought, how is this possible? Because there's labor involved. Things that are always done cost more than the raw ingredients. What's happening?
You said the raw chicken costs twice as much as the rotisserie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I've seen that, but I've seen something like that.
Uh-huh.
Well, this story, which appeared on the website kcet.org.
I think it might be a public radio or public TV. I don't know. But anyway, that essentially the rotisserie chickens are often chickens that have already been out for sale and get pulled as they approach their sell-by date, and that it's a way to prevent food waste in grocery stores.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
It does.
I often want a rotisserie chicken when I go shopping at Whole Foods on a Sunday, but I would say at least half the time the rotisserie chickens are just sold out. I feel like they disappear the minute they get put out.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's a way. It's certainly a way to move them. And what was interesting about this article, too, is it went more, it went deeper than just the rotisserie chicken. It talked about how so much of, like, the prepared food section you see at a grocery store is, it's not just that they're preparing all this food with sort of, you know, the stuff that's come in that day, that it's things that they're prepping that have been out in sort of another format that need to be used. And so they're sort of working it through the system to make it more appealing to the consumer.
That doesn't bother me even at all. I feel like that's only smart.
No, I am. I'm a big believer in the idea that, like, sell-by dates are kind of ridiculous. And I live with someone who lives and dies by a sell-by date or a best-by date. And I was like, it's fine.
You have to trust your senses.
Yeah, although, I mean, anytime, I don't remember what it was, but recently there was something and it was like a year old. Like, the best-by date was a year and Scott wouldn't let me use it. He threw it away and I'm like, it's fine.
In my mind, I'm like, is it unopened yogurt? Because that's okay.
It was something that was like unopened. And he was like, no. And I was like, but it's fine.
Yeah. Well, well, the reasons that they were giving for, and I, you know, especially at Whole Foods, which is the place I buy my rotisserie chickens, they're like the same price as the, even the organic, you know, it's very similar in price. So it's hard to resist. And so the question this article raises is like, how do they do that?
Yeah.
And, you know, or why? And you touched on one thing, which is they're using up chickens that are at the end of their life is one explanation. Another explanation is it's a loss leader.
Yeah.
And they did, the story talked a lot about Costco, which I think is a place you belong.
Yes, we are Costco members.
The story said basically, like, most Costco members really only come once a month or once every 2 months and stock up on a lot of bulk items. But when you have something like a really competitively priced rotisserie chicken, it might get people into the store where maybe they'll buy more stuff or have more ideas to buy stuff later. You know, they'll just see the merchandise, which makes a lot of sense to me. Another thing they pointed out is that the rotisserie chicken is often not the same chicken that you would buy in the in the butcher's case. The rotisserie chicken is typically only like 2.5 pounds uncooked, whereas most chickens that you buy in the butcher's case are going to be like 3 to 4 pounds.
That is true. So they're much smaller. And also there's just the economy of scale. Like, you know, and I do feel like perhaps the raw chickens that you buy to cook at home, they're priced a little bit higher with the expectation that there's going to be some sort of loss in there. Whereas like the rotisserie chickens, once they're cooked, you know, people just gobble them up.
Yeah.
Because there's an ease factor.
True.
I will say I do love the Costco roast chicken, and I often wish that there was a Costco in Philadelphia proper so that I could swing in more often.
Yeah.
And buy one of their chickens.
I'm seriously considering joining Costco, by the way. At least, you know, we talked about the book Real Food, Fake Food a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And then Marisa, you know, got a copy. I think the publisher sent you a copy and you lent it to me. And I already read it. It's so interesting.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I forgot to bring it back, but I will. So they recommend Costco over and over in the book for, you know, real food, you know, things to be accurately labeled. And it just really, you know, appealed to me.
Well, Costco is one of the only places I feel comfortable buying olive oil these days because I know that they have such high standards. And, you know, I also, we have a friend who used to work in the flavor industry, and she said that Costco always insisted on, so like, the best vanilla extracts and things like that. And so they just have very, very high standards. Well, and yeah. I appreciate that.
We'll put the link to this story on our show notes, and you read it. I think if you're interested in rotisserie chicken, you will also find it fascinating. And tell us what you think in the comments about rotisserie chicken prices, Costco, or anything of the sort.
So we are still in the heat of summer, although it's finally starting to break a little bit. But I am still singularly unexcited by hot food for dinner. And so lately, I have been turning to cold soups as a way to sort of bridge the gap, because I miss soup. I like a bowl of something.
I made hot soup earlier this week.
Did you really?
Just to spite summer. I did. I made a ginger garlic coconut chicken soup with zoodles.
So good.
I was steaming.
Oh.
I was like, just turned down the air conditioning and ate it. I was like, I want soup. Darn it.
That sounds great. Yeah, but I've been turning to, even if not cold, but like room temperature, a soup that it's fine eaten, sort of not when it's piping hot.
What are your favorites?
So I'm a big fan of traditional gazpacho, but that is often a little too tomato-y for my spouse. And so he prefers a tomato that's cooked. So I'll even do just a cold tomato soup or a room temperature tomato soup, you know, with tomatoes that have been cooked and then pushed through food mill with some onion and garlic and some spices and just kind of eaten at room temperature, maybe with a little Parmesan cheese and toast.
It sounds tasty.
It's really nice. I also, for myself, for lunch, I will often just put in the blender like a cucumber, a chopped up cucumber with some yogurt and a little sweet onion and puree that and add a little lemon juice and salt. And it's essentially like a, like almost like a dip that I'm eating for lunch with a spoon, but it's delicious.
You know what I would encourage you to try?
What?
The Canal House ladies have a recipe in one of their books, and I think you have them all.
I have all of them, yes.
It's for cucumber avocado buttermilk soup.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Really,
that sounds
really
delicious.
I've made that several times, and it's just one of my favorite chilled soups. I also like a white gazpacho. Maybe Scott would like that if it's tomatoes that are giving him a problem.
Yeah, perhaps.
I know he likes cauliflower.
Yeah.
I actually did a recipe for Food and Wine one time that was like a Spanish style white gazpacho with cauliflower and almonds. And it was very good.
That sounds delicious. I'll have to look for that.
Like you said, though, about eating the dip one time. Well, I just get the feeling like I'm eating sauce or something, like a condiment. So I have to have something else with a cold soup. I like to have, with the aforementioned cucumber avocado buttermilk soup, I like to do a smoked salmon tartine for some reason.
That sounds good.
Just like a piece of toast with cream cheese and a smoked salmon on top of it. Or, I don't know, with gazpacho, I need to have like a quesadilla or just something to like break up the...
Yeah, I definitely will always do it with like toast or something like that or crackers. I also like a good garnish. I used to feel like garnishes, like what's the point of a garnish? But I definitely have been, I've come around to garnishes.
Well, texture, it adds another texture.
Exactly. And sometimes what I'll do is like crisp up, I'll chop up like really good deli meat, like a deli sliced ham and crisp it up just in a dry skillet and use that as the topping because it adds a little protein, adds a little crunch. And it's like a toasted nut or something like that or some seeds or something. It all helps kind of give it texture and extra sticking power, because the problem with a chilled soup is it's often vegan or vegetarian, and then you don't have a lot of like stuff that stays with
you. That's another good thing about that avocado version of the cucumber soup I mentioned. It's more filling because of all the delicious and healthy fat in an avocado.
I do love an avocado. I have some ripe avocados in the refrigerator right now.
Maybe. And perhaps. I know you have cucumbers.
I do. I definitely have cucumbers.
The height of canning season, and Maurice is up to her eyeballs in cucumbers.
I'm almost through my 40 pounds. Oh, my God. I am truly insane. Anyway. I recognize that.
So let's talk about an appliance that is new in your life that I've had since Christmas.
Yes.
On Facebook, readers have asked us to revisit this topic because I know a lot of people have also gotten them. And that It's the Instant Pot.
Yay!
So what do you think?
I really like it. So I got my Instant Pot on Amazon Prime Day in July because...
Along with 250,000 other people. Yes,
obscene numbers of Instant Pots were sold that day.
Over 250,000. I wasn't exaggerating.
It's amazing. But it's a really great piece of equipment. I am totally in love. And like everything in my life lately, I've been using it for canning related activities. So I'm not canning in my Instant Pot, but I am using it to prep fruit for like fruit butter. One of the things I really love doing with it is cooking peaches in it for like 8 minutes. And that softens the skin enough that you can puree them and you don't have to peel peaches, which is really nice because once that like all that heat and pressure.
Do you put them on a rack with some water? How do you just put them right in?
I use such juicy peaches that I didn't even add any water. Huh. But if your peaches were at all underripe or hard, I would add maybe like half a cup of water.
I was wondering if it would scorch on the bottom.
It didn't scorch because, I mean, literally they were like dripping. By the time I filled the insert with peaches, there was, you know, I would say half an inch of peach juice in the bottom of the pot. Yeah, it was amazing just how quickly it cooked them. And then it didn't take long at all to cook them down into butter.
Let's just walk back for a second and tell people what the Instant Pot is in case you haven't heard of this device yet. It's billed as a 7-in-1 cooker because it performs 7 functions. Let's see if I can name them. It's a pressure cooker.
Yes.
A slow cooker. It's sort of like an electric skillet in that it can saute. It steams food.
It's a rice maker.
It's a rice maker.
It's a yogurt maker.
And it's a yogurt maker. So maybe it's 6-in-1.
I think some of them are set. I feel like some of them are 7-in-1. What else would it do?
I'm not sure. But what I mainly use it for is pressure cooking. And I have been known to steam in it. I do sometimes use the saute function at the beginning of a recipe. Okay. So if you did know, now you know.
Yeah. Now you know what it does.
So what else have you done?
I have done beans. I did just basic dried beans, which I know you're going to talk about more.
Yes.
It's definitely sort of a game changer. What else did I use it for? Oh, I mean, again, I've mostly used it for prepping fruit. I did a batch of apple butter in it, too, where I used it to cook the apples until tender. And again, I didn't peel them. And it just pulverized the skins. And so this is always a thing in canning. Like, do you peel your apples and peaches or not? And it is definitely, if you're going to puree them, you don't have to peel anymore with an Instant Pot. You can cook your fruit in it and the skins. And it just adds up.
From a nutrition perspective, yeah, it's much better to keep the skins. Oh my goodness. I think we should have planned a longer segment for this.
Well, we can keep on going.
We have some more time.
Yeah.
But there's just so many things I want to say.
Go for it. Let's dive in.
Let's talk about beans for a minute. I, yesterday, in my Instant Pot, made the most perfect pinto beans I have ever made in my life. And it's a combination of the Instant Pot and brining.
Okay.
I learned brining from America's Test Kitchen. Which is basically just put your beans in salty water for like 6 hours to 24 hours before you cook them. And I used to like follow the directions very specifically in terms of the amount of salt, amount of water, amount of beans. But now I just like literally throw 2 tablespoons of salt in a big-ish mixing bowl, stir it up with water till the salt dissolves, and then put in like 1 cup of beans. It's not that precise. And what it does give the beans, it does season the beans to some extent, but what it mostly does is some kind of chemical reaction in the skin that allows the beans to really plump and take in water and get very creamy and tender without the skins breaking. I've struggled with the broken, like if you want to cook beans until they're really tender, you often get a bunch of broken beans.
Yeah.
Or if you want to have the skins intact, and then maybe your bean is not as cooked as you'd like it to be. Brining plus Instant Pot solves this problem totally.
It's amazing.
Did you soak your beans before you put them in the Instant Pot?
No. And I had a lot of broken beans because...
Yeah, I really want you to try it.
I'm going to, because I definitely have suffered through many a broken bean because I always want my beans to be tender.
Yes.
Rather than crunchy on the inside. But you do often sacrifice that exterior sort of integrity if you want your beans to be cooked all the way through. So I will, the next time I make beans, brine them first.
Would you say you really like beans?
I love beans.
Okay, this is going to blow your mind. Like, I cannot believe how the complete perfection of this, the perfectly tender bean with the intact skin is, like, changing my life, my cooking life. I'm going to eat so many more beans now.
So, tell me a little bit about what you did with your beans.
Well, one thing I did was I used them yesterday to make just some quick tacos for myself for lunch. Oh, I did a weird thing. I don't know where I got this idea, but it turned out really tasty. I baked a sweet potato and put like a little bit of mashed sweet potato in the shell in the tortilla.
That sounds delicious.
Then I put on some homemade hot sauce. Then I put the beans on and then cilantro, onion, lime. It was so good.
And sounds like it may have been vegan even.
Yes, it actually was.
That's crazy.
I don't know why the sweet potatoes were so good. It was like a nice counterpoint to the hot sauce, and it actually made the beans stick to the tortilla so they weren't falling out everywhere. And then this morning I had them for breakfast. I want to add beans to my usual breakfast because they are so nutritious.
Yeah.
I've been doing a lot of writing in the diabetes realm lately. And all of the experts on nutrition and diabetes, or almost all of them, recommend beans for their fiber content, their antioxidants. They make you full. You know, beans are definitely a superfood for blood sugar control. So
fantastic.
And there's even a contingent of low-carb people that are like low-carb with beans. They're called the slow-carb people.
Oh, that's funny.
And yeah, anyway.
I've always felt kind of strange. I feel like beans are amazing. And the whole paleo movement, I'm like, why? Why do we have to eliminate all the legumes?
And let me just give you my other public service announcement about the Instant Pot.
Yeah.
Have you joined the Instant Pot group on Facebook yet?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you should. It's very interesting.
Okay.
And I use the Instant Pot mainly to make components of stuff I'll make later.
Yeah.
Like beans. Like brown rice and other whole grains, chicken stock.
Yeah.
I want to make yogurt in it. I haven't done it yet. There are very few things where I just put all the ingredients in the Instant Pot and then dinner is served out of the Instant Pot. I think that that's not the highest, best and highest use of the machine. It's also not quite instant because it takes, you know, like, I don't know, maybe your chicken drumsticks take 15 or 20 minutes, but it's going to take the thing like 10 or 15 minutes to come up to pressure. So. Yeah. It's not as instant as maybe the name would imply, and it's better to make the things you need to make the thing than it isn't making the thing. All right, I think that I got everything out on the Instant Pot that I needed to say.
Yeah, no, I feel like I've only just begun to explore what it can do for me. And I have been someone who has used pressure cookers in the past. Mm-hmm. At this time, I have two pressure cookers and a pressure canner. So I'm not afraid of pressure, but I do love the control and the ease you get from it versus needing to control on the stove. Because as someone with an electric stove, controlling the heat and pressure in a pressure cooker has always been a little bit of a challenge. And so that's one of the things I really appreciate. So if you're scared of pressure cooking,
it feels safe.
It sort of eliminates that worry because it's taking care of it for you. It's not going to be able to over pressurize and have an explosion. Because I know that, you know, a lot of people are afraid of pressure cooking from like days of yore when pressure cookers weren't nearly as safe. I know my grandmother once was making a roast in a pressure cooker and took the lid off before to depressurize and it exploded. And so you don't have that sort of thing. It's a way of making pressure cooking really accessible and safe for people who are nervous about it. And it's a great way to save some energy because it's faster cooking. So, and,
you know, it's cool.
Yeah.
It's cooler than having your oven on all day or whatever. The other neat feature about it, and I used this yesterday, is when it's programmable. So you put things in for a certain time. And when the time is up, it switches to keep warm and it holds the food at a food safe temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So like with the beans, I've been very busy with work this week, as you know. And with the beans, I set it and then I knew that I could just get involved in whatever else that I would do. And they would just be there for me when I was done. So like they probably sat in the cooker for like an hour after they were done cooking. No bad effects. Yeah.
Fantastic.
So, I mean, you'd think Instant Pot was paying us to do this segment, but they're really not. And no one is urging me to tell you to buy one, but you should buy one.
No, but it's really a great tool. Okay. So let's transition and talk about our fall, or I guess it was our summer cookbook, because it is still summer, our summer cookbook club pick, which was Rachel Roddy's My Kitchen in Rome. Now, I love this book. I have cooked from it, but I also have just used it as inspiration.
It's so full of text and essays and ideas.
And I feel like it's the kind of cookbook where you could spend years kind of dipping back into it and always finding new things and new ways to sort of approach food. And I love how it transports you.
Mm-hmm.
There is really sort of a a travel through writing that's happening in this book that I really appreciated. What do you think of it?
Well, there's that. There's the narrative component and all of this inspiration and little stories. And what really stood out to me was the simplicity of the food and the recipes. Yeah. You know, it was kind of refreshing. There were definitely recipes in there that were very similar to recipes that I already make, but her approach to them made me think of it in a different way, like the clams and spaghetti recipe, for example. And the other thing that really stood out at me, this is kind of like on a granular level, but there's so much fresh mint in this book.
I love fresh
mint. I never have thought of mint as an Italian ingredient, really, but it's featured prominently throughout.
And obviously, you know, it must grow readily in Rome, at least where she is, because there's so much of it. One of the things that I really enjoyed about it just is sort of her commitment to a minimal, useful kitchen. Now, obviously, I do not have a minimal kitchen, but for instance, she has a section just entitled The Food Mill and praises the food mill. Now, we all know I love you my do. Food mill. And so it's, you know, that moment where I'm like, ah, yes, comrade. Here's a piece of kitchen equipment that I feel like is unsung. And here's someone else sort of singing its praises. And so there's lots of little things like that in this book where I go, ah, yes, this speaks to me. And I really appreciate that.
Something else that happened while I was reading this book is I did come across some ingredients where I was like, whatever, maybe you can get that in a farmer's market in Rome, but not here. And I'll be a little more specific. She, in one recipe, calls for zucchini. This is zucchini cooked in olive oil. And it says, ideally the pale, creamy, green, or rib variety with flowers still attached. I was like, whatever, Rachel. Then, the very next day, I went to my farmer's market and saw that very thing.
Oh, funny.
The pale, creamy, green, or rib variety with the flowers still attached. I was like, I'll take all those. and then I went home and I made her dish and it was really delicious.
Oh, that's so funny.
Wasn't as exotic as I thought. It was just a weird serendipity.
That is so funny. And you know, you live in South Philly. You live in sort of, you know, a traditionally Italian neighborhood. So I guess in some regards, it's not surprising, but it was
an Amish farmer that had them.
Funny.
They were delicious.
Funny. That sounds so good. Yeah, I've really enjoyed everything I've made from this book.
Do you have a favorite?
It's just one of her simple little soups of like an onion and a potato and, you know, simmer together and then some chickpeas and nothing special, but just easy and approachable and delicious. And I've always been someone who's like potatoes and beans, you know, it's sort of like beans and pasta to me, like so many carbs, so many starches all at once. But potatoes and beans together are magical. Because they're creamy, but in different ways. And a little onion and garlic. So good.
That's true. They are creamy in different ways.
And so it has really made me appreciate the simplicity of how it doesn't, you know, like a pot of soup doesn't have to be a ton of different things. It can be just a handful of ingredients that you sort of simmer together, cook slowly, and how nice that can be.
Yeah. Well, when I get a cookbook, I'm always looking for some new technique that is a little unfamiliar to me.
Yeah.
My favorite recipe by a mile in this book was the stuffed tomatoes.
I have that marked. I have so many tomatoes. I was going to make that tonight.
Okay. I have some advice.
Okay.
Not really advice. I mean, her recipe is great. I made it twice, though. Okay. So let me back up.
Is the rice stuffed?
Yes. The magic of this recipe is that there's really no water involved.
Okay.
It's the tomato juices and pulp that hydrates the rice and cooks the rice.
Okay.
So it is extremely flavorful. She recommends that you stuff the tomatoes with the rice and the tomato pulp. There's like salt and olive oil and some basil, I think, in it. And then she says to let it sit for an hour or something, or 2 hours. I can't remember. But I also did it where I let it sit overnight, let it soak overnight.
Oh.
That was better.
Was it? Okay.
And she also recommends letting this, after you've cooked them, let the tomatoes stand for at least an hour, maybe 2 hours. And there again, longer is better.
Okay.
And finally, she includes a mess of potatoes, like under the tomatoes, which I was tempted to skip this step. That would have been an error. Because the juices from the tomato and the olive oil combine and it becomes like a dark, sticky, flavorful, like very soft and creamy roasted potato with like just the right amount of browning and tomato flavor. It, like, it blew me away. You are going to love it. Don't skip the potatoes.
I won't skip the potatoes. God, it sounds so good. It just, if you haven't, if you're looking for a book that sort of can inspire you and make you a better home cook, I feel like this is one that can do that for you.
Mm-hmm. It is very inspiring, full of good ideas.
And just a pleasant book to read cover to cover too.
Right. You know what I didn't make yet, but I really want to make is the ricotta and lemon bun pound cake or lemon bun cake.
Oh God, that sounds so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have, there's a recipe towards the back for a cherry jam tart. And I'm like, I have cherry jam. I have sour cherry jam. Yum. I need to make this.
Delicious. Yeah. I really loved cooking from it, and I know that I'm going to be making things from it for probably the whole year to come.
Oh, I'm glad.
I gravitated towards the summeriest parts for now.
Well, it has been the heat of summer. So again, that was Rachel Roddy's book, My Kitchen in Rome. You can also find more of her recipes on her website, Rachel Eats. And she also writes a column for The Guardian. And there's lots of good things that come out of that column as well. So definitely look her up.
I have a new favorite place to shop at the market.
Tell me about it.
Just in recent weeks, there's been a new meat vendor, Primal Supply Meats.
I'm very excited about them.
It's all local, pastured and grass-fed. It's ground beef, ground pork, sausages. And she does have it's Heather Thomason, who's the former butcher of Kensington Quarters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for those of you in Philadelphia, now she started this business where, and she has a stand at the Fountain Farmers Market where I go, but there's also a subscription. So you can get like a box. It's like a CSA where you get a box every week of, I think it includes like a pound of ground beef, a pound of sausage, or, you know, you can get chicken, whole chickens.
Yeah.
And the prices are pretty reasonable, all things considered. Most things are around $11 a pound, which for that type of meat is not expensive, really.
Yeah.
And I've been buying the ground beef. It's really good.
Is it?
Yeah. I think I'm going to have burgers made out of it tonight.
That sounds delicious.
And I also have meatloaf planned for it. I bought 2 pounds this week, actually, because meatloaf is always great for the freezer.
Yeah, I think. That is true.
I know you have your own sources for locally grass-fed.
Yeah,
type.
I've been buying from Meadow Run Farm for years and years now. But I do love, and I think one of the things that I think I like so much about Primal Meat is it's a woman-owned business, which is kind of cool. You don't find a lot of women in meat.
It's true. We did a feature about her in Edible Philly that sort of focused on her. She was teaching classes for women, butchery classes for women. It can be intimidating, you know, for women to wield the knife and approach the side of beef or even the whole chicken, you know. So I definitely appreciate that about her, too. If you live in South Philly and you can go to the Fountain Farmers Market, it's like very easy to just stop by and pick up a pound of beef. Or if you want to make a bigger commitment to local meat, you should consider joining the Butcher's Club there. I think I might do it after I move.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because what happens when the farmers market closes? I need a...
Yeah, that's true.
I'm still going to want to have... I'll probably want it more. To have whole chickens and ground meat and sausage.
Is it coming frozen or is
it's fresh?
Oh, that's my like gosh. The cool thing. Because that's the one problem with Meadow Run Farm and these other buying clubs that I've, you know, dabbled in, is that it all comes frozen.
Right.
And so there is something really appealing about having it all be fresh and you can choose whether you freeze it or not.
That's true. I mean, it doesn't really, I don't know. The thing about the frozen is you can't make it that night, which I have been doing. I've been doing like a Primal Supply themed dinner on a Wednesdays now because of her.
That's awesome.
Well, if you have your preferred sources for local meat, tell us about them in the show notes. We always want to know where we can get this kind of local food that we love.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I think that's it for this week. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. You can sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.